easy.com/live_energy-effic_appl.htm. Heat and cool your house efficiently. Heating and cooling your house can be a major energy drain, typically accounting for about 45% of a household's total energy use. Pay attention to how high or low your thermostat is set, avoiding unnecessary cooling or heating. Lowering your heat by just a few degrees in the winter and setting your air conditioner a couple of degrees higher in the summer can add up to real energy savings over time. And using a programmable thermostat allows you to adjust temperatures automatically, for example, while you are sleeping or at work. Also, where possible, install smart meters and explore combined heat and power systems. Insulate your house. Properly insulating your house can save money by eliminating energy leaks that add to your heating or cooling needs. A drafty house lets warm air escape in the winter and lets cool air out in the summer, which puts more pressure on heating and cooling systems and expends more energy to keep the house comfortable. Check for drafts around windows and doors and seal up any leaks, or consider installing higher efficiency windows. Make sure to seal all attic vents and ducts. Insulate your water heater and hot water pipes to keep the heat in the water where it belongs. For more specific information, visit www.simplyinsulate.com. The Consumer Federation of America's checklist of 10 simple ways to cut energy costs includes these and other suggestions to reduce your greenhouse gas emissions. Visit www.buyenergyefficient.org. Get a home energy audit. Performing a comprehensive energy audit can help identify areas of your home that are consuming the most power. For an informative do-it-yourself tool to conduct your own audit, visit www.energyguide.com. This site will take you through a step-by-step evaluation of your home, factoring in the structure of your house or apartment, number of rooms, type of heating system, etc. Using this data, the guide offers individualized suggestions for how to reduce energy use, while providing tools to calculate the amount of potential energy savings from specific actions. The typical household spends an average of $1,500 per year on energy and can save as much as $450 or more by implementing some simple energy efficiency measures. There are also professional home energy auditors who can give you thorough home energy efficiency assessments. To find an energy specialist in your area, contact your utility company or state energy office. Conserve hot water. Heating water is one of the major draws on household energy. You can cut energy use by setting your water temperature no higher than 120 degrees Fahrenheit. You can also conserve hot water by taking showers rather than baths, and by installing efficient, low-flow shower heads. Consider the water requirements of appliances such as dishwashers and washing machines, as some use less hot water than others. For example, front-loading washing machines are much more efficient than top-loading machines. Washing clothes in warm or cold water rather than hot can be a big energy saver as well. Reduce standby power waste. Many appliances, including televisions, DVD players, cell phone chargers, or any other piece of equipment that has a remote control, battery charger, internal memory, AC adapter plug, permanent display, or sensor, use electricity even when they are turned off. In fact, 25% of the energy a television uses is consumed when it is not even powered on. The only way to be sure your appliance is not using power is to unplug it, or to plug it into a power strip, which you can then switch off. Power strips do consume a small amount of energy, but far less than the phantom load appliances leak when plugged in directly. Improve the efficiency of your home office. Energy-efficient computers are equipped with a power management feature that, when enabled, causes the computer to go into a low power mode. because computers are commonly left on when not in use, enabling power management can save 70% of the energy normally used by a computer. Also be aware that laptop computers are 90% more energy efficient than desktop models. Inkjet printers consume 90% less energy than laser printers, and printing in color uses more energy than printing in black and white. When possible, choose multifunction devices that print, fax, copy, and scan, as they use less energy than individual machines would.
Switch to green power. Although most energy in the United States comes from fossil fuels, more and more people are electing to use energy generated by cleaner sources, such as the sun, wind, the heat of the earth, or the burning of biomass. For more information about these various alternative sources of energy, visit www.eere.energy.gov/consumer/renewable_energy. In fact, wind and solar power are among the fastest growing sources of energy, both in the United States and around the world. For more information about solar energy, visit www.ases.org. And for wind energy, visit www.awea.org. There are a number of different ways to participate in this shift to renewable energy. Many homeowners have begun to produce their own electricity by installing solar photovoltaic cells, wind turbines, or geothermal heat pumps. It is estimated that some 150,000 households have become energy self-sufficient, removing themselves entirely from the energy grid. Many more have reduced their reliance on public utilities, using them only to supplement the renewable power they generate themselves. In some states, households that produce more electricity than they need for their own use can sell the surplus back to the utility. This is called two-way or net metering. In this manner, individuals can not only reduce their own carbon emissions, but also supply clean energy to the public utility. Many state and local governments and some utility companies offer personal tax credits or subsidies for renewable energy projects. For more information, visit the Database of State Incentives for Renewable Energy at www.desireusa.org. For those who aren't in a position to install their own renewable energy systems, there is another way to participate in the shift to green power. In many regions, consumers can contract with their utility companies to receive energy from more environmentally friendly sources. There may be a slightly higher cost for green power, but in general, the premium is negligible and will likely come down as more consumers elect this option. For more information, visit www.epa.gov/greenpower or www.eere.energy.gov/greenpower. If green power is not available through your public utility, you have the option of purchasing tradable renewable energy certificates, TRCs, to offset your energy use. For more information, visit www.green-e.org. Reduce emissions from cars and other forms of transportation. Almost one-third of the carbon dioxide produced in the United States comes from cars, trucks, airplanes, and other vehicles that transport us from place to place, or are used in the course of producing and delivering the goods and services we consume. More than 90% of this travel is by automobile, which means that fuel economy standards are of critical importance. Average gas efficiency for passenger vehicles has actually declined over the last decade, largely because of the increased popularity of SUVs and light trucks. New regulations that impose more stringent standards on these vehicles will hopefully reverse this trend, and further innovations in gas economy, alternative fuels, and hybrid technology will provide more eco-friendly options. Here are some solutions on the horizon, as well as a few things you can do in the meantime to reduce the carbon emissions you produce in the course of your travels. Reduce the number of miles you drive by walking, biking, carpooling, or taking mass transit wherever possible. The average car in the United States releases about 1 pound of carbon dioxide for every mile driven. Avoiding just 20 miles of driving per week would eliminate about 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions per year. For advice on how to lobby for better pedestrian conditions, visit www.americawalks.org. And for better biking conditions, visit www.bikeleague.org. A free national service is available to help you coordinate your travels with other commuters. For more information, visit www.erideshare.com. For more information about how to use and support the expansion of mass transit, visit www.publictransportation.org. Drive smarter. Some simple changes in driving habits can improve your vehicle's fuel efficiency and reduce your greenhouse gas emissions when you must drive. Avoid commuting in rush hour, if possible. You'll waste less time sitting in traffic, and your vehicle will consume less fuel. Observe the speed limit, and not only for safety reasons. A car's fuel economy drops off sharply at speeds above 55 miles per hour. Avoid unnecessary idling and keep your car in good running order. Regular maintenance improves performance and reduces emissions. And as much as possible, plan ahead and combine different errands into one trip. For specific information about maximizing the fuel efficiency of your car, visit www.fueleconomy.gov/FEG/drivehabits.shtml. Make your next vehicle purchase a more efficient one. The recent rise in gasoline prices has increased interest in our car's fuel efficiency. Driving a car that gets more miles to the gallon will not only save you cash at the gas station, it will also reduce your carbon dioxide emissions from driving. Every gallon of gasoline burned puts about 20 pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So, a vehicle that gets 25 rather than 20 miles per gallon produces 10 fewer tons of carbon dioxide in its first 100,000 miles. Comfort needn't be sacrificed to gain fuel economy. You can look up fuel efficiency estimates for most cars at the U.S. Department of Energy's online Green Vehicle Guide at www.epa.gov/autoemissions or www.fueleconomy.gov. Hybrids. Hybrid cars run on a mix of gasoline and electricity. And because the battery charges as you drive, they never need to be plugged in. Since the electric motor assists the regular combustion engine, hybrids consume far less gas and are much cleaner for the environment. Some hybrid cars get up to 50 miles per gallon. Demand for these vehicles is growing at a feverish rate, and many new models, including sedans, hatchbacks, SUVs, and pickups, are now or will soon be available. For more information about how hybrids work and to compare models, visit www.hybridcars.com. Alternative fuels. The fuel of the future is going to come from fruit like that sumac out by the road, or from apples, weeds, sawdust, almost anything. There is fuel in every bit of vegetable matter that can be fermented. There's enough alcohol in 1 year's yield of an acre of potatoes to drive the machinery necessary to cultivate the fields for 100 years. Henry Ford spoke these prophetic words in 1925. Some 90 years later, we are seeing the application of such innovations, including the use of numerous biofuels derived from renewable plant materials, including corn, wood, and soybeans. The most commonly used renewable fuels today are biodiesel and ethanol. Fuel cell vehicles. A hydrogen fuel cell is a device that converts either pure hydrogen or hydrogen-rich fuel directly into energy. cars powered by fuel cells may be twice as efficient as similarly sized conventional vehicles, or even more as new technologies advance efficiencies. A fuel cell vehicle, FCV, that uses pure hydrogen produces no pollutants, only water and heat. FCVs, while exciting, are still several years away from reaching a mass market. To learn more about fuel cell technology, visit www.fueleconomy.gov/FEG/fuelcell.shtml. Telecommute from home. Another way to reduce the number of miles you drive is by telecommuting. You'll spend less time and energy on the road and be able to devote more attention to business at the same time. For further information about telecommuting, visit the Telework Coalition at www.telcoa.org. Reduce air travel. Flying is another form of transportation that produces large amounts of carbon dioxide. Reducing air travel, even by one or two flights per year, can significantly reduce emissions. Take vacations nearer to home, or get there by train, bus, boat, or even car. Buses provide the cheapest and most energy-efficient transportation for long distances, and trains are at least twice as energy-efficient as planes. If your airplane travel is for business, consider whether you can telecommute instead. If you must fly, consider buying carbon offsets to compensate for the emissions caused by your air travel. For assistance in planning green travel and purchasing carbon offsets, visit www.betterworldclub.com/travel/index.htm.
Reduce emissions by consuming less and conserving wisely. In America, we have grown used to an environment of plenty, with an enormous variety of consumer products always available and constant enticement to buy more, new, and improved. This consumer culture has become so intrinsic to our worldview that we've lost sight of the huge toll we are taking on the world around us. By cultivating a new awareness of how our shopping and lifestyle choices impact the environment and directly cause carbon emissions, we can begin to make positive changes to reduce our negative effects. Here are some specific ideas on how we can achieve this. Consume less. Energy is consumed in the manufacturing and transport of everything you buy, which means there are fossil fuel emissions at every stage of production. A good way to reduce the amount of energy you use is simply to buy less. Before making a purchase, ask yourself if you really need it. Can you make do with what you already have? Can you borrow or rent? Can you find the item secondhand? More and more Americans are beginning to simplify their lives and choose to reduce consumption. For ideas on how to pare down, visit www.newdream.org. Buy things that last. Reduce, reuse, and recycle has become the motto of a growing movement dedicated to producing less waste and reducing emissions by buying less, choosing durable items over disposable ones, repairing rather than discarding, and passing on items that are no longer needed to someone who can make use of them. For more information about the three R's, visit www.epa.gov/msw/reduce.htm. To learn how to find a new home for something you no longer need, visit www.freecycle.org. Precycle. Reduce waste before you buy. Discarded packaging materials make up about one-third of the waste clogging our landfills. Vast amounts of natural resources and fossil fuels are consumed each year to produce the paper, plastic, aluminum, glass, and styrofoam that hold and wrap our purchases. Obviously, some degree of packaging is necessary to transport and protect the products we need. But all too often, manufacturers add extraneous wrappers over wrappers and layers of unnecessary plastic. You can let companies know your objection to such excess by boycotting their products. Give preference to those products that use recycled packaging or that don't use excess packaging. When possible, buy in bulk and seek out things that come in refillable glass bottles. Recycle. Most communities provide facilities for the collection and recycling of paper, glass, steel, aluminum, and plastic. While it does take energy to gather, haul, sort, clean, and reprocess these materials, recycling takes far less energy than does sending recyclables to landfills and creating new paper, bottles, and cans from raw materials. It has been suggested that if 100,000 people who currently don't recycle began to do so, they would collectively reduce carbon emissions by 42,000 tons per year. As an added benefit, recycling reduces pollution and saves natural resources, including precious trees that absorb carbon dioxide. And in addition to the usual materials, some facilities are equipped to recycle motor oil, tires, coolant, and asphalt shingles, among other products. Don't waste paper. Paper manufacturing is the fourth most energy-intensive industry, not to mention one of the most polluting and destructive to our forests. It takes an entire forest, more than 500,000 trees, to supply Americans with their Sunday newspapers each week. In addition to recycling your used paper, there are things you can do to reduce your overall paper consumption. Limit your use of paper towels and use cloth rags instead. Use cloth napkins instead of disposables. Use both sides of paper whenever possible, and stop unwanted junk mail. For information about how to remove your name from mailing lists, visit newdream.org/junkmail or www.dmaconsumers.org/offmailinglist.html. Bag your groceries and other purchases in a reusable tote. Americans go through 100 billion grocery bags every year. One estimate suggests that Americans use more than 12 million barrels of oil each year just to produce plastic grocery bags that end up in landfills after only one use and then take centuries to decompose. Paper bags are a problem, too. To ensure that they are strong enough to hold a full load, most are produced from virgin paper, which requires cutting down trees that absorb carbon dioxide. It is estimated that about 15 million trees are cut down annually to produce the 10 billion paper bags we go through each year in the United States. Make a point to carry a reusable bag with you when you shop. And then when you're asked, paper or plastic, you can say, neither. To purchase reusable bags, learn more bag facts, and find out about actions you can take, visit www.reusablebags.com. Compost. When organic waste materials such as kitchen scraps and raked leaves are disposed of in the general trash, they end up compacted deep in landfills. Without oxygen to aerate and assist in their natural decomposition, the organic matter ferments and gives off methane, which is the most potent of the greenhouse gases, 23 times more potent than carbon dioxide in global warming terms. Organic materials rotting in landfills account for about one-third of man-made methane emissions in the United States. By contrast, when organic waste is properly composted in gardens, it produces rich nutrients that add energy and food to the soil, and of course, also decreases the volume added to our landfills. For information about how to compost, visit www.epa.gov/compost/index.htm or www.mastercomposter.com. Carry your own refillable bottle for water or other beverages. Instead of buying single-use plastic bottles that require significant energy and resources to produce, Buy a reusable container and fill it up yourself. In addition to the emissions created by producing the bottles themselves, imported water is especially energy inefficient because it has to be transported over long distances. If you're concerned about the taste or quality of your tap water, consider using an inexpensive water purifier or filter. Also, consider buying large bottles of juice or soda and filling your own portable bottle daily. Using your own mug or thermos could also help reduce the 25 billion disposable cups Americans throw away each year. Modify your diet to include less meat. Americans consume almost a quarter of all the beef produced in the world. Aside from health issues associated with eating lots of meat, a high meat diet translates into a tremendous amount of carbon emissions. It takes far more fossil fuel energy to produce and transport meat than to deliver equivalent amounts of protein from plant sources. In addition, much of the world's deforestation is a result of clearing and burning to create more grazing land for livestock. This creates further damage by destroying trees that would otherwise absorb carbon dioxide. Fruits, vegetables, and grains, on the other hand, require 95% less raw materials to produce and, when combined properly, can provide a complete and nutritious diet. If more Americans shifted to a less meat-intensive diet, we would greatly reduce carbon dioxide emissions and also save vast quantities of water and other precious natural resources. Buy local. In addition to the environmental impact that comes from manufacturing the product you are buying, the effects of CO2 emissions from transporting those goods at each and every stage of production must also be calculated. It is estimated that the average meal travels well over 1,200 miles by truck, ship, and/or plane before it reaches your dining room table. Often it takes more calories of fossil fuel energy to get the meal to the consumer than the meal itself provides in nutritional energy. It is much more carbon efficient to buy food that doesn't have to make such a long journey. One way to address this is to eat foods that are grown or produced close to where you live. As much as possible, buy from local farmers markets or from community-supported agricultural cooperatives. By the same token, it makes sense to design your diet as much as possible around foods currently in season in your area, rather than foods that need to be shipped from far-off places. Purchase offsets to neutralize your remaining emissions. So many things we do in our day-to-day lives, driving, cooking, heating our homes, working on our computers, result in greenhouse gas emissions. It is virtually impossible to eliminate our personal contributions to the climate crisis through reducing emissions alone. You can, however, reduce your impact to the equivalent of zero emissions by purchasing carbon offsets. When you purchase carbon offsets, you are funding a project that reduces greenhouse gas emissions elsewhere by, for example, increasing energy efficiency, developing renewable energy, restoring forests, or sequestering carbon in soil. For more information and links to specific carbon offsetting organizations, visit www.nativeenergy.com/climatecrisis. Our actions to help solve the climate crisis can well extend beyond the ways we personally reduce our emissions. By continuing to learn about the state of the environment and what is being done about it, we can inform and inspire others to action. We can bring awareness to our neighborhoods, schools, and workplaces, and find ways to implement programs in these and other communities. As citizens of a democracy, we can support candidates who show a record of environmental responsibility, and we can exercise our right to vote for leaders committed to sustainability. We can voice our disapproval when our elected leaders pursue policies detrimental to the environment, and we can lobby in support of programs and actions that advance global cooperation on this issue. As consumers, we can use our purchasing and investing power to send messages of support to corporations and outlets that show integrity and leadership, and messages of intolerance to those that demonstrate negligence and denial. Let others know. Share what you've learned with others. Tell your family, your friends, and your colleagues about climate change and what they can do to participate in the solution. If you have the opportunity, speak to a wider audience or write an op-ed piece or a letter to the editor of your local or school newspaper. Share this audiobook or any other resource that will help others understand the importance of this issue. Encourage your school or business to reduce emissions. You can further extend your positive influence on emissions well beyond your own home by actively and directly encouraging others to take appropriate action. Think about how you might affect others in your workplace, school, place of worship, and elsewhere. Vote with your dollars. Find out which brands and stores are making efforts to reduce their emissions and to conduct their businesses in an environmentally responsible manner. Support their practices by purchasing their products and shopping in their stores. Make companies that are negligent aware of your objections. Let them know that until they change their energy-inefficient ways, you'll take your business elsewhere. Consider the impact of your investments. If you invest, you should consider the impact that your investments have on climate change. Whether you keep your money in a simple savings account at a bank or local credit union, buy stocks, invest in mutual funds for your retirement, or manage your child's college fund, it matters where your money goes. There are resources for savers and investors that help ensure that money is being invested in companies, products, and projects that responsibly address climate change and other sustainability challenges. Moreover, considering sustainability issues when making investment decisions doesn't mean lower returns on your investments. Indeed, there is evidence that it can actually enhance them. Many of the largest investment organizations in the world have endorsed this view. You can read some of this research at www.socialinvest.org/areas/research. Take political action. Climate change is a global issue, and your personal actions are a critical first step toward reducing greenhouse gases in the United States and throughout the world. For governments, this is fundamentally a political challenge, which means that individuals can make a difference by pressuring their elected representatives to support measures that have a positive impact on the climate crisis. At all levels of government, decisions are routinely made that have the potential to affect greenhouse gas emissions. Some U.S. cities have agreed to reduce their emissions in line with the amount the entire United States would have committed to had it signed the International Kyoto Protocol, which requires signatory nations to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, as of December 2005, 194 cities representing 40 million Americans had made this pledge as part of the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement. For more information, visit www.ci.seattle.wa.us/mayor/climate. Clearly, we must demand an even more dramatic commitment from our government. If we don't express our views loudly and clearly, the corporate special interests who steadfastly oppose mandatory reductions in greenhouse gas emissions will continue to prevail. To learn more about where politicians and candidates stand on global warming, visit www.lcv.org/scorecard. Get the facts and make sure your voice is heard.
Ultimately, the question comes down to this. Are we, as Americans, capable of doing great things, even though they might be difficult? Are we capable of transcending our own limitations and rising to take responsibility for charting our own destiny? Well, the record indicates that we have this capacity. We fought a revolution and brought forth a new nation based on liberty and individual dignity. We made a moral decision that slavery was wrong, and that we could not be half free and half slave. We recognized that women should have the right to vote. We won two wars against fascism simultaneously in the Atlantic and the Pacific, and then we won the peace that followed. We cured fearsome diseases like polio and smallpox, improved the quality of life, and extended our lifetimes. We took on the moral challenge of desegregation and passed civil rights laws to remedy injustice against minorities. We landed on the moon, one of the most inspiring examples of what we can do when we put our minds to it. We have even solved a global environmental crisis before. The problem of the hole in the stratospheric ozone layer was said to be impossible to fix because the causes were global and the solution required cooperation from every nation in the world. But the United States took the lead on a bipartisan basis with a Republican president and a Democratic Congress. We drafted a treaty, secured worldwide agreement on it, and began to eliminate the chemicals that were causing the problem. Now, all over the world, we are well on our way to solving the stratospheric ozone crisis. Now, it's up to us to use our democracy and our God-given ability to reason with one another about our future and make moral choices to change the policies and behaviors that would, if continued, leave a degraded, diminished, and hostile planet for our children and grandchildren, and for humankind. We must choose instead to make the 21st century a time of renewal. By seizing the opportunity that is bound up in this crisis, we can unleash the creativity, innovation, and inspiration that are just as much a part of our human birthright as our vulnerability to greed and pettiness. The choice is ours. The responsibility is ours. The future is ours. One of the robotic spacecrafts that America launched years ago to explore the universe took a picture as it was leaving Earth's gravity, a picture of our planet spinning slowly in the void. Years later, when the same spacecraft had traveled 4 billion miles beyond our solar system, the late Carl Sagan suggested that NASA send a signal instructing the craft to turn its cameras toward the Earth again, and from that unimaginable distance, take another photograph of Earth. The picture it sent back to us shows a pale blue dot visible in the center of the band of light stretching across a vast, dark void. The pale blue dot is us. As Sagan noted, everything that has ever happened in all of human history has happened on that tiny pixel. All the triumphs and tragedies, all the wars, all the famines, all the major advances. It is our only home. And that is what is at stake. Our ability to live on planet Earth, to have a future as a civilization. This is a moral issue. It is our time to rise again, to secure our future.
An Inconvenient Truth was written by Al Gore and read by Beau Bridges, Cynthia Nixon, and Blair Underwood. It was adapted for audio by Jesse Boggs and was recorded at Voice Tracks West in Studio City, California, Carnegie Hall Studios in New York, and Mark Grau Recording Studios in Burbank, California. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. It was mixed by Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Amory Klimchak. An Inconvenient Truth was directed by Elisa Shokoff and Fred Sanders and produced by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Your Majesties, Your Royal Highnesses, Honorable Members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. I have a purpose here today. It is a purpose I have tried to serve for many years. I have prayed that God would show me a way to accomplish it. Sometimes, without warning, the future knocks on our door with a precious and painful vision of what might be. 119 years ago, a wealthy inventor read his own obituary, mistakenly published years before his death. Wrongly believing the inventor had just died, a newspaper printed a harsh judgment of his life's work, unfairly labeling him the merchant of death because of his invention, dynamite. Shaken by this condemnation, the inventor made a fateful choice to serve the cause of peace. 7 years later, Alfred Nobel created this prize and the others that bear his name. 7 years ago tomorrow, I read my own political obituary in a judgment that seemed to me harsh and mistaken, if not premature. But that unwelcome verdict also brought a precious, if painful, gift, an opportunity to search for fresh new ways to serve my purpose. Unexpectedly, that quest has brought me here. Even though I fear my words cannot match this moment, I pray that what I'm feeling in my heart will be communicated clearly enough that those who hear me will say, "We must act." The distinguished scientists with whom it is the greatest honor of my life to share this award have laid before us a choice between two different futures, a choice that to my ears echoes the words of an ancient prophet: life or death, blessings or curses, therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency, a threat to the survival of our civilization that is gathering ominous and destructive potential even as we gather here. But there is hopeful news as well. We have the ability to solve this crisis and avoid the worst, though not all, of its consequences if we act boldly, decisively, and quickly. However, despite a growing number of honorable exceptions, too many of the world's leaders are still best described in the words Winston Churchill applied to those who ignored Adolf Hitler's threat. And I quote, "They go on in strange paradox, decided only to be undecided, resolved to be irresolute, adamant for drift, solid for fluidity, all-powerful to be impotent." So today, we dumped another 70 million tons of global warming pollution into the thin shell of atmosphere surrounding our planet as if it were an open sewer. And tomorrow we will dump a slightly larger amount, with the cumulative concentrations now trapping more and more heat from the sun. As a result, the Earth has a fever, and the fever is rising. The experts have told us it is not a passing affliction that will heal by itself. We asked for a second opinion, and a third, and a fourth. And the consistent conclusion, restated with increasing distress, is that something basic is wrong. We are what is wrong, and we must make it right. Last September 21st, as the northern hemisphere tilted away from the sun, scientists reported with unprecedented alarm that the North Polar ice cap is, in their words, falling off a cliff. One study estimated that it could be completely gone during summer in less than 22 years. Another new study to be presented by U.S. Navy researchers later this week warns it could happen in as little as 7 years. 7 years from now. In the last few months, it has been harder and harder to misinterpret the signs that our world is spinning out of kilter. Major cities in North and South America, Asia, and Australia are nearly out of water due to massive droughts and melting glaciers. Desperate farmers are losing their livelihoods. Peoples in the frozen Arctic and on low-lying Pacific islands are planning evacuations of places they have long called home. Unprecedented wildfires have forced 500,000 people from their homes in one country and caused a national emergency that almost brought down the government in another. Climate refugees have migrated into areas already inhabited by people with different cultures, religions, and traditions, increasing the potential for conflict. Stronger storms in the Atlantic and the Pacific have threatened whole cities, Millions have been displaced by massive flooding in South Asia, Mexico, and 18 countries in Africa. As temperature extremes have increased, tens of thousands have lost their lives. We are recklessly burning and clearing our forests and driving more and more species into extinction. The very web of life on which we depend is being ripped and frayed. We never intended to cause all this destruction, just as Alfred Nobel never intended that dynamite be used for waging war. He had hoped his invention would promote human progress. We shared that same worthy goal when we began burning massive quantities of coal, then oil and natural gas. Even in Nobel's time, there were a few warnings of the likely consequences. One of the very first winners of the prize in chemistry worried that, in his words, we are evaporating our coal mines into the air. After performing 10,000 equations by hand, Svante Arrhenius calculated that the Earth's average temperature would increase by many degrees if we doubled the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. 70 years later, my teacher Roger Revelle and his colleague Dave Keeling began to precisely document the increasing CO2 levels day by day. But unlike most other forms of pollution, CO2 is invisible, tasteless, and odorless, which has helped keep the truth about what it is doing to our climate out of sight and out of mind. Moreover, the catastrophe now threatening us is unprecedented, and we often confuse the unprecedented with the improbable. We also find it hard to imagine making the massive changes that are now necessary to solve the crisis. And when large truths are genuinely inconvenient, whole societies can, at least for a time, ignore them. Yet, as George Orwell reminds us, sooner or later, a false belief bumps up against a solid reality, usually on a battlefield. In the years since this prize was first awarded, the entire relationship between humankind and the Earth has been radically transformed. And still, we have remained largely oblivious to the impact of our cumulative actions. Indeed, without realizing it, we have begun to wage war on the Earth itself. Now we and the Earth's climate are locked in a relationship familiar to war planners, mutually assured destruction. More than 2 decades ago, scientists calculated that nuclear war could throw so much debris and smoke into the air it would block life-giving sunlight from our atmosphere, causing a nuclear winter. Their eloquent warnings here in Oslo helped galvanize the world's resolve to halt the nuclear arms race. Now science is warning us that if we do not quickly reduce the global warming pollution that is trapping so much of the heat our planet normally radiates back out of the atmosphere, we are in danger of creating a permanent carbon summer. As the American poet Robert Frost wrote, "Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. Either," he notes, "would suffice. But neither need be our fate. It is time to make peace with the planet. We must quickly mobilize our civilization with the urgency and resolve that has previously been seen only when nations mobilized for war. These prior struggles for survival were won when leaders found words at the 11th hour that released a mighty surge of courage, hope, and readiness to sacrifice for a protracted and mortal struggle. These were not comforting and misleading assurances that the threat was not real, not imminent, that it would afflict others but not ourselves, that ordinary life might be lived even in the presence of extraordinary threat, that providence could be trusted to do for us what we would not do for ourselves. No, these were calls to come to the defense of the common future. They were calls upon the courage, generosity, and strength of entire peoples, citizens of every class and condition who were ready to stand against the threat once asked to do so. Our enemies in those times calculated that free people would not rise to the challenge. They were, of course, catastrophically wrong. Now comes the threat of climate crisis, a threat that is real, rising, imminent, and universal. Once again, it is the 11th hour. The penalties for ignoring this challenge are immense and growing, and at some near point would be unsustainable and unrecoverable. For now we still have the power to choose our fate. And the remaining question is only this: have we the will to act vigorously and in time, or will we remain imprisoned by a dangerous illusion? Mahatma Gandhi awakened the largest democracy on earth and forged a shared resolve with what he called satyagraha, or truth force. In every land, the truth, once known, has the power to set us free. Truth also has the power to unite us and bridge the distance between me and we, creating the basis for common effort and shared responsibility. There is an African proverb that says, if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We need to go far, quickly. We must abandon the conceit that individual, isolated, private actions are the answer. They can and do help, but they will not take us far enough without collective action. At the same time, we must ensure that in mobilizing globally, we do not invite the establishment of ideological conformity and a new lockstep-ism. That means adopting principles, values, laws, and treaties that release creativity and initiative at every level of society in multifold responses originating concurrently and spontaneously. This new consciousness requires expanding the possibilities inherent in all humanity. The innovators who will devise a new way to harness the sun's energy for pennies or invent an engine that's carbon negative may live in Lagos or Mumbai or Montevideo. We must ensure that entrepreneurs and inventors everywhere on the globe have the chance to change the world. When we unite for a moral purpose that is manifestly good and true, the spiritual energy unleashed can transform us. The generation that defeated fascism throughout the world in the 1940s found in rising to meet their awesome challenge that they had gained the moral authority and long-term vision to launch the Marshall Plan, the United Nations, and a new level of global cooperation and foresight that unified Europe and facilitated the emergence of democracy in Japan, Germany, Italy, and much of the world. One of their visionary leaders said, "It is time we steered by the stars and not by the lights of every passing ship." In the last year of that war, you gave the Peace Prize to a man from my hometown of 2,000 people, Carthage, Tennessee, in the USA. Cordell Hull was described by Franklin Roosevelt as the father of the United Nations. He was an inspiration and hero to my own father, who followed Hull in the Congress and the U.S. Senate, and in his commitment to world peace and global cooperation. My parents spoke often of Hull, always in tones of reverence and admiration. 8 weeks ago, when you announced this prize, the deepest emotion I felt was when I saw the headline in my hometown paper that simply noted I had won the same prize that Cordell Hull had won. In that moment, I knew what my father and mother would have felt were they alive. Just as Hull's generation found moral authority in rising to solve the world crisis caused by fascism, so can we find our greatest opportunity in rising to solve the climate crisis. In the kanji characters used in both Chinese and Japanese, crisis is written with two symbols, the first meaning danger, the second opportunity. By facing and removing the danger of the climate crisis, we have the opportunity to gain the moral authority and vision to vastly increase our own capacity to solve other crises that have been too long ignored. We must understand the connections between the climate crisis and the afflictions of poverty, hunger, HIV, AIDS, and other pandemics. As these problems are linked, so too must be their solutions. We must begin by making the common rescue of the global environment the central organizing principle of the world community. 15 years ago, I made that case at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. 10 years ago, I presented it in Kyoto. This week, I will urge the delegates in Bali to adopt a bold mandate for a treaty that establishes a universal global cap on emissions and uses the market in emissions trading to efficiently allocate resources to the most effective opportunities for speedy reductions. This treaty should be ratified and brought into effect everywhere in the world by the beginning of 2010, 2 years sooner than presently contemplated. The pace of our response must be accelerated to match the accelerating pace of the crisis itself. Heads of state should meet early next year to review what was accomplished in Bali and take personal responsibility for addressing this crisis. It is not unreasonable to ask, given the gravity of our circumstances, that these heads of state meet every 3 months until this treaty is completed. We also need a moratorium on the construction of any new generating facility that burns coal without the capacity to safely trap and store carbon dioxide. And most important of all, we need to put a price on carbon with a CO2 tax that is then rebated back to the people progressively according to the laws of each nation in ways that shift the burden of taxation from employment to pollution. This is by far the most effective and simplest way to accelerate solutions to this crisis. The world now needs an alliance, especially of those nations that weigh heaviest in the scales where Earth is in the balance. I salute Europe and Japan for the steps they've taken in recent years to meet the challenge, and the new government in Australia, which has made solving the climate crisis its first priority. But the outcome will be decisively influenced by two nations that are now failing to do enough, the United States and China. While India is also growing fast in importance, it should be absolutely clear that it is the two largest CO2 emitters, and most of all my own country, that will need to make the boldest moves or stand accountable before history for their failure to act. Both countries should stop using the other's behavior as an excuse for stalemate and instead develop an agenda for mutual survival in a shared global environment. These are the last few years of decision, but they can be the first years of a bright and hopeful future if we do what we must. No one should believe a solution will be found without effort, without cost, without change. Let us acknowledge that if we wish to redeem squandered time and speak again with moral authority, then these are the hard truths. The way ahead is difficult. The outer boundary of what we currently believe to be feasible is still far short of what we actually must do. Moreover, between here and there, across the unknown, falls the shadow. That is just another way of saying that we have to expand the boundaries of what is possible. In the words of the Spanish poet Antonio Machado, "Pathwalker, there is no path. You must make the path as you walk." We are standing at the most fateful fork in that path. So I want to end as I began, with a vision of two futures, each a palpable possibility, and with a prayer that we will see with vivid clarity the necessity of choosing between those two futures and the urgency of making the right choice now. The great Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen wrote, "One of these days, the younger generation will come knocking at my door." The future is knocking at our door right now. Make no mistake, the next generation will ask us one of two questions. Either they will ask, "What were you thinking? Why didn't you act?" Or they will ask instead, "How did you find the moral courage to rise and successfully resolve a crisis that so many said was impossible to solve?" We have everything we need to get started, save perhaps political will. But political will is a renewable resource. So let us renew it, and let us say together, we have a purpose. We are many. For this purpose, we will rise and we will act.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.